But this evening, I want to talk about the last lesson in the series of application of all the things that we've talked about. Thus far in this study, we have examined the right to make judgments in religious matters. We have looked, and in personal matters, that God gives us the right to judge in certain matters. In Matthew 7 and verse 1 through 5, where we began this study, "Judge not that you be not judged," does not mean that all judging is wrong and that any judgment you make, you violate God's law. We've looked at there are judgments and decisions that all of us must make in accordance with the will of God. That's true in religious matters. It's true in personal matters. We've also examined the standard of judgment. When we're talking about a religious subject, or when we're talking about a religious decision, we're talking about a standard of God. That is the only standard that any of us can compare and make a righteous judgment. And this judgment must be made according to that standard. We talked about the characteristics of making fair judgment. What is the character traits of one who would make righteous judgment? We talked about that. And then we talked about judging others. And we talked about the warning of judging others too harshly. And remember the teaching of Matthew 7, by whatever measure we judge, by that same measure we're going to be judged. And I think it'd do well for us to remember that particular teaching of our Lord in Matthew chapter 7. And then we looked at the subject of extending mercy. We know that God extends us mercy on an everyday basis. We have no problem understanding that we would not ever have a hope of heaven if it were not for a merciful and gracious God. There would be no way that any of us would make it. That being so, God intends for his children to be just as merciful, to be as merciful as we possibly can, to give the benefit of the doubt. Don't ever compromise truth. Don't ever do anything that would put you in a position of encouraging error, but be merciful, be understanding. And we talked about that from a biblical sense. And then last week, we discussed gathering evidence and we discussed witnesses for a few moments. And we looked at what the Bible has to say in those areas. Tonight, I want to talk about, in spite of our sincere efforts to make righteous judgment, to make judgment that's in accordance with God's will, to not be hypocritical, to not make judgments that we one day will find out that we could lose our soul over, to make sure that that doesn't happen, we can still easily be trapped into making poor judgments. Now the question is begged is why? Why do we still make poor judgment after we've got all of these tools and aids that can help us make better judgment? Well, the easy answer to that question is because we're human beings. I could just answer that and that'd be the end of that discussion because we're all human. We're not infallible. We can make mistakes. But I want to offer you something a little bit more than that this evening. Often it is due to uncritical acceptance of fallacious arguments. There are people that make fallacious arguments in order to justify, and they arrive at conclusions based upon those arguments that are not according to Scripture. We will study these not only to avoid being deceived by them, but also that we might never use them ourselves in arriving at a judgment. But I think the first thing we need to do is define our word. What do I mean by fallacious? Here is what I mean. When I'm talking about fallacious judgment, here is what I'm talking about. Containing or based on a fallacy. A fallacious assumption tending to mislead. Now this is important. Tending to mislead. It's involved where you are purposely trying to mislead people with the truth. It's something that's conscious. It's not something you do and you really don't know you're doing it. You make a conscious effort to do it. To mislead. To be deceptive. To deceive. To make things appear what they're not. A false notion. Based on an assumption, based on something that I believe, but something that we can't prove by the Scripture. Incorrectness of reasoning. And basically, I could sum all this up by saying simply, it's what I want it to be. A fallacious argument could be what I want it to be. It's something that I can create to do whatever I want to do with it and justify and rationalize any decision or judgment that I come to. And brethren, anybody can do this. And don't think that people in the Lord's church are immune to this, because they're not. And we're going to talk about 12 things that are fallacious judgments. And we're not going to spend a great deal of time, but I'm going to show you that the Bible does talk about them. Now, the first one comes from a Latin term. The first one I want to talk about is the ad hominem attack. Now, you know, I hope I said that right. Rita's been quizzing me all day, and I'm only going to say it once. If I said it wrong, I said it wrong. But this is the Latin term. But what does it mean? Well, let me tell you what it means. This is a Latin term which literally means to the man. Now, I said, well, that doesn't tell me anything either. Well, it refers to an argument which is directed against prejudicial character of an individual, such as physical appearance, origin, speech, race, sex, or other personal quality. This is the substance of their argument instead of proof or evidence. They attack the person. Brethren, people in debating have become masters at this. And what we do is we attack the character and we attack the person, and we never deal with the argument. You can't make a judgment on that. How do you ever arrive at truth? By never examining the evidence, by never examining the text. Name calling and attacking one's character doesn't answer the biblical truth. That's what's important. Now let me show you that this is used and been done for centuries. Turn over to John chapter 7. This was even done to Jesus. In John chapter 7, look at verse number 33. John chapter 7, verse 33. Then Jesus said to them, I shall be with you a little while longer, and then I will go to him who sent me. You will seek me and not find me, and where I am, you cannot come. Now, instead of dwelling and trying to understand what Jesus said, what did they do? Look at verse 35. Then the Jews said among themselves, where does he intend to go that we will not find him? Does he intend to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks? They're not even trying to understand what he's saying. They're trying to cloud the issue by attacking the things that he says instead of dealing with the truth that he just told them. You remember the blind man in John chapter 9? Do you remember them bringing him in a couple of times and then bringing his parents in and trying to get their stories not to match up? Do you remember the conclusion that the Pharisees came to with the blind man? Look at John 9 and verse 34. What did they conclude finally when they couldn't shake his story and when they couldn't get away from the facts? What judgment did they come up with? Look at verse 34. They answered and said to him, you were completely born in sins. Are you teaching us? And they cast him out. You know, casting him out didn't answer the question, who healed him? Jesus healed him. But instead of dealing with the evidence, instead of dealing with the facts, they try to impugn his character and say, you're a sinner and you're trying to teach us. And they just threw him out. You know what? It still didn't answer the fact. They still never dealt with the truth of it, did they? And it didn't change it by throwing him out. You see, they just tried to avoid it. What about 2 Corinthians 10? Do you remember Paul when he wrote the 1 Corinthians letter? Remember one of the things that was said about his character in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 10, here's what those he addressed these letters said. For his letters, they say, are weighty and powerful, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech is contemptible. What does that have to do with what Paul wrote? That has nothing to do about what Paul wrote. And you know what? He says later on, he says he's going to come, and however he's going to come, either in kindness or if he's going to have to come and be harsh, it's going to depend on how they receive his letter. But you notice what they did is attack his character and try to make it appear that he really wasn't what he said he was. But you know what? They even did that to Jesus in John 8 and verse 41 when he was telling them about his deity, telling him that he was sent from God, and it was getting a little too hot for him. And they couldn't answer his arguments. What did they do? 41, here's what they said. You do the deeds of your father. They said to him, we were not born of fornication. We have but one father, God. You hear what they're doing? They're accusing him of being born of fornication because he was born of Mary and Joseph before they were married. So he's really an illegitimate son. And he's trying to teach them. You know, all of that, even if it was true, and it wasn't true, but even if it was true, does not address the truth that Jesus is trying to get them to see. Now, all this is to avoid the issue. That's all this does, is avoid the issue. We're not going to give proof. We're not going to give evidence. We're not going to give fact. We're just going to attack the person or the character. James 2, verses 1 through 4, talks about this characteristic. Now, brethren, this term of pointing the argument to the man instead of dealing with the facts and the evidence is unscriptural and it's unjust. It's unscriptural and it's unjust. Deal with the fact. You know what? People would have a whole lot different perspective about debating if we left personalities out of it. If we just debated the issue. If we just debated the truth. That would be much more beneficial. But you know what? You pick up many debate books today, you're going to have to read through a lot of material that's unnecessary to ever get to the truth if you ever find it. That's the problem, and you can't make a right, proper judgment if you use this type of judgment, if you use this type of attack. Then you have bomb-based. It's another approach that some use. This word is defined as flammable, pompous speech. It is distinguished from eloquent speech like we have in Acts 18:24. It's just the opposite of that. This judgment has no substance. The speaker seeks to persuade simply by impressing the audience with his ability to speak. I'm going to tell you, TV evangelists got this down to science. You just listen to them all, they can great order. They can speak, but where's the substance? Where's the substance? Where's the truth? It's missing. Let me give you an example. This was done in the Bible. Turn over to Acts chapter 12. Remember Herod? Remember Herod in Acts chapter 12, verse 21? So they set a day. Herod arrayed in royal apparel, sat on his throne, and gave an oration to them. And the people kept shouting, the voice of a God and not a man. Remember what happened to Herod? He was struck, and it's kind of disgusting, really, if you think about it. He was stricken with worms, and he died. But he took away glory that belonged to God. He took it upon himself. You see, he was a great orator, but that didn't make what he said truthful. Turn over to Acts 24, and you remember when they were trying Paul? They bring down a great orator, Tertullus. They're going to bring him down, and they're going to let him offer their case. Notice in verse 2, and when he had called upon Tertullus, he began to make accusations, saying, seeing that through you enjoy great peace and prosperity is being brought to this nation by your foresight, we accepted always and in all places most noble Felix with all thankfulness. Needless to say, not to be tedious to you any further, I beg you to hear by your courtesy a few words from us. You know what he's doing? He's buttering him up. He's not saying anything of substance. He didn't have any evidence against Paul. He was a great orator. That's why they hired him. But there wasn't any substance there. Brethren, how can you make a judgment on that? How can you make a judgment about truth just because somebody has a lot of ability to be a great orator? That doesn't prove anything. We also see the same thing in Romans 16 when we're warned about smooth words and flattering speeches. That doesn't determine truth. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, and verse 3 through 4, Paul warns about those who would have itching ears. And teachers would teach those who have itching ears and would preach the things that they would like and things that they wanted to hear. But you know what? That started a long time before Paul warned Timothy. You remember back in the Old Testament, in Jeremiah, he made the prophecy that the prophets prophesied falsely, and my brethren love it to be so. You know, we've got some of these bomb-based preachers in the brotherhood. They can say a lot of things. They're really good speakers. They're great, really great orators, but there's no substance in what they're saying. And brethren, nobody can make a determination if there's any truth, because they have a great speaking ability. There's got to be some substance there for somebody to make a judgment. You know, I thought all my life that being a gospel preacher meant that you preach the gospel, not tell stories, not prove anybody about how great orator you are. I always thought the gospel was to be preached was the gospel. But people are tired of that. People want something that will impress them and will turn their head and impress them by the great oratory ability. Brethren, that just does, that's making a flimsy judgment. You can't make a judgment based on how great an orator somebody is. Does he have evidence? Does he have proof? Is there any substance to what he says? If there's not, how can you make a judgment? You can't. This really leads into the third one. Intellectualism. Now, I personally know nothing about this one, but I know what the book says, what it means. Intellectualism is seek to impress the audience, and it's a form of bombast with a display of personal knowledge. Again, intellectualism is distinguished from a mere deep discussion that seeks to magnify the speaker rather than the truth. Is truth generally hard to understand? I mean generally. I know there's things written that are hard to understand. Paul said that, and Peter said that. There's some things written that's hard to understand. But in a general sense, is truth difficult to understand? I don't believe it's true. John 8, verse 32, Jesus said, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." This line of reasoning is hard to follow. It's over the heads of most people. You know what? If you listen to somebody give an oration, and you've got to go home and go to your dictionary instead of the Bible, you didn't get edified. Now, brethren, what I'm talking about is trying to impress people with an education and with our ability instead of impressing them with truth. There's a difference. I'm not against higher education. I'm not against an intellectual, because you can learn a lot from people who are smarter than you. That's fine. But if I'm going to base and have people be impressed because how much I know and how little they know, brethren, you can't make a judgment on that. And you know, sometimes when we get in discussions with people that we differ with, we sometimes come across this way, that we got all the answers and you don't got any. You need to sit down and be quiet and listen to what I have to say. And sometimes we come across that way, brethren, and we don't understand why we don't convert anybody. Brethren, intellectualism is not a basis for determining truth. It's not. There's got to be some substance there. There's got to be something that's understood. You know, when I was in the military, one of the things that all the time in the classes I took and had to take was how to communicate. And one of the things you have to communicate is there's got to be a line of understanding. There's got to be a person speaking and a person being able to understand what's being spoken. And if the person who is listening doesn't understand what's being spoken, there is no communication. And brethren, it's the same way in teaching and preaching. If there's going to be somebody that's going to make a judgment about something, and you get some intellectual up that's going to just impress body with his knowledge and with his ability to be a great orator and with all the knowledge he's had, but there's no substance in what he says, how can you make a judgment? You can't make a judgment like that. That is something, and we read this in Acts chapter 17 about the teachers in Athens and also the Greeks. We're told in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 22 through 25, that the Greeks seeked after wisdom. Nothing wrong with wisdom, but when worldly wisdom comes up against the wisdom of God, it pales. There's no comparison. That cannot allow the proper, judgment to be made. This next one you're probably more familiar with. The rest of these you'll be a lot more familiar with. The bandwagon approach. The bandwagon approach for making fallacious judgment. I think you can figure out what this one is. The bandwagon approach is sometimes we ask to do or to believe something simply because everyone else believes it, or the majority of people are doing it or believe it. Men of importance are in the movement. Is truth determined by the number of people who believe it and who those people are? Does that determine truth? Let me tell you what happened to me a few years ago. I was having a real difficult time in a particular subject. And I, studying this, and man, I was just having a really tough time. And I called this preacher who was close to me, who had been referred to me by somebody else, and was much older than me, and had been preaching much longer than me. And I asked him about this particular subject, and it was something that was being discussed at great length among brethren. And here was his quote. I'm going to quote him exactly. He said, "Well, I'll tell you, Keith, what I'm doing is I'm just going to wait until the dust settles. I'm going to see who goes where, and then I'll be better able to make a decision." Brethren, that's not how you make a decision. That's not how you arrive at a judgment. Brethren, the Bible tells us in John chapter 7. Turn over to John chapter 7 for a minute. In John chapter 7, the rulers of the Pharisees, in verse number 45, "Then the officers came to the chief priests and Pharisees, who said to them, 'Have you not brought him?' And the officers answered and said, 'No man ever spoke like this man.' Then the Pharisees answered them, 'Are you also deceived? Have any of the rulers or the Pharisees believed in him? But this crowd that does not know that the law is a curse.'" In other words, do you see us following him? Do you see any of the Pharisees following him? Now, if we're not following, do you think he's telling the truth? You know what that is? That's also a form of intimidation. But you see what, you know, we're somebody. We understand the law. We've got a good grasp, but you don't see us following him, do you? Why should you follow him? Brethren, that doesn't prove anything. In 2 Corinthians 10, verse 12, the Bible makes this statement. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse number 12. "For we dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who command themselves." Let me read that again. That's a good verse. "For we dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who command themselves. But they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves among themselves, are not wise." Now that was written by inspiration. And it says it's dangerous when men compare themselves with themselves. The Bible also tells us in Matthew 7 that the majority is not right. "Not everyone that said to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven." And then in verse 22 and 23, he talks about those who come to him and say, "Hey, we've done all these great things. We cast out these demons. We've done all these wonderful works." What's Jesus going to say in verse 23? "Depart from me, ye workers of iniquity. I never knew you." What? Say, "Hey, wait a minute. Look at all these religious people that were doing this. Look at who was teaching. Look at all these renowned men." What's Jesus going to say? What did my book say? What did the Bible say? That's what he's going to say. Brethren, that approach doesn't work. We also read in Proverbs 14, verse 12, "There's a way that seems right, but the ways there are the ways of death." You know, remember Noah? He could have took the bandwagon approach. Everybody but eight souls didn't care about God. Why Noah just joined them? Eight souls were right and the whole world was wrong. That tells me the majority is not always right. We can also remember the Jews. The Jews weren't the most in number, but they had God, and they had God on their side, but they were willing to give that up. But what I'm getting at is we shouldn't determine to make a judgment by who's standing where. By, you know, if this person is here, that must be true, so I'm going to stand there. I want to give you a little warning about myself. Don't you believe anything because Keith Greer believes it. Don't you believe it because you heard me preach it. You don't believe it unless you can find it, book, chapter, and verse in this Bible. You don't become my disciple. And you don't jump on it because everybody else is jumping on it. You make sure a "thus saith the Lord" is behind you. The Bible also talks about the assertion. I love this. The assertion. What am I talking about when I talk about the assertion? Well, the assertion is simply a claim that something is true. An empty assertion that's missing two things: facts and evidence. Anybody can make an assertion. Anybody can make an assertion, but there's no evidence, and there's no truth, and there's no proof. It's an empty assertion. It differs from a statement of fact in that the assertion has no credible evidence to support it. Now, Genesis 3, verse 4, the devil made an assertion. The serpent made an assertion. Go ahead and eat of the tree. You won't die. That's an assertion. What did he have to back that up? Nothing. That was an assertion. In John chapter 9, remember when they came up on that blind man? Remember what his disciples asked him? Oh, Jesus, who sinned? This man or his parents? That's an assertion. What proof is there that man's blind because him or his parents sinned? Where's the proof in that? And Jesus answered correctly. He said, neither did this man sin nor his parents sin. You see, you don't hear bad things because your parents do bad things, because you sin and then bad things happen to you. The Bible doesn't teach you. That's an empty assertion. How about the false charges against Paul in Acts 25, verse 7? They were without foundation, no truth in them. They were blank, empty assertions. A repeated assertion even adds further to the persuasiveness of an argument. If you keep making an empty assertion and you keep making it and making it, pretty soon it takes on the appearance of truth. The more that you make it, the stronger the assertion gets. Let me give you an example. Genesis chapter 27, verse 19 through 24, with the deception of Jacob and Rebekah. It wasn't bad enough that Jacob got in it and then Rebekah backed him up. That was an assertion with no fact. We also, how about Matthew 26, the denial of Peter? He didn't do it once. He didn't do it twice. He did it three times. And he denied Peter. Empty assertions do not prove truth. The repeated assertion when carried to an extreme is a form of brainwashing. I'll give you an example of three. Crossroads, the Boston movement, and also the Jim Jones movement that happened in Indianapolis, Indiana, not very far from here. He based it all on an assertion. And he kept pressing the point, and 900 people followed him to their death. Where was the evidence? Where was the support? How about Crossroads? That almost destroyed. That destroyed a good number of churches in the mid-70s, in the early 80s. The Boston movement is still doing that. Now it's called the International Churches of Christ. Where was the evidence? Where was the facts? Where were the facts to make the judgment? All these men did is make empty assertions that had no facts or evidence behind them. But you know what? Somebody believed it, somebody accepted it, and somebody obeyed it and did something with it. You know the result. An assertion that has no fact can't make a judgment. Here's one. The straw man. The straw man. We build a straw man that we accuse someone of believing something that they do not believe. And then we tear them down. Look at Acts chapter 21. Acts chapter 21 and verse 21. Now all these approaches make righteous judgment not possible. Acts 21 verse 21. But they have been informed about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to be circumcised their children nor walk according to the custom. They built a straw man against Paul. And that way they could set him up and they could say that he was an enemy of theirs and he was something that somebody they had to watch. They just built a straw man because Paul no longer taught the law that he was converted to Christ. Right? A straw man's easy. You better be careful what you accuse somebody of believing until you know that they believe it. Until they told you that they believe it. Or there's some evidence, there's a preponderance of evidence that they believe it. Don't claim somebody believes something you have no evidence to back it up. That's a straw man. And that's easy to do. And this really is one that we do when we get in differences with our religious friends. We often build straw men. And they build straw men in their argument to try to tear us down. I remember talking to an individual not a few years ago. He said, well, you people of the Church of Christ, said, you don't believe in the Old Testament. Who told you that? Who told you that we don't believe in the Old Testament? I believe that Moses parted the Red Sea. I believe God made a great fish and swallowed Noah. I believe that the walls of Jericho fell. I believe God created the world in 6 days. I believe that the kingdom divided. I believe that there were 12 tribes of Israel. Who told you that we don't believe in the Old Testament? You see, that's a straw man. You know what that does? That's to make somebody prejudiced against what we believe. Rather, you can't make a judgment by doing that. Hurry along. What about the false dilemma? The false dilemma, what am I talking about there? The false dilemma. Dilemma is choice. between unsatisfactory alternatives. We face many legitimate dilemmas in our life. Such choices are very uncomfortable, but sometimes they are necessary. However, we at times call upon people to choose between A and B, when in truth, A and B are not the only choices. It's a false dilemma. Let me give you an example of one. I just told you about John 9. Who sinned? This man or his parents, A or B? That's a false dilemma, because both are wrong. There's another choice there. What about Matthew 22:15-21, when it talked about Caesar the Lord? Now, who do we obey? Do we obey Caesar or do we obey the Lord? That's a false dilemma. You give Caesar what Caesar's entitled to, and you give the Lord what he's entitled to. There's a C choice there, but we give people two choices, and we put them in a false dilemma. Brethren, that's fallacious judgment. You know, I remember somebody explained this to me like this. You go up to some man, and you say, have you stopped beating your wife? Well, he's done either way, he answers that. No matter which way it goes, if he says yes, well, he never should have started beating her. And if he says no, then he's still beating her. He's wrong either way. You see, that's a false dilemma. And sometimes we put people in that kind of a position. Now, you ever had anybody say, well, whose side are you on? I've had preachers say, well, whose side are you on? I had a preacher not too many years ago make the statement to me, well, you've got to decide which side you're on. You're either with us or you're with them. I got news for you, folks. I'm going to stay right here with God. I'm not going to get on either side. I'm going to stay with God. That's a false dilemma, brethren. How about a faulty analogy? A faulty analogy. A faulty analogy is sometimes described by comparing apples and oranges. It often takes form of an illustration or a hypothetical situation. We must remember, illustrations only illustrate. Whether they are illustrating truth or error is entirely another matter. In Matthew chapter 22, remember the illustration that they gave to Jesus? Remember this man? He had a wife. And he died. And his brother took him to wife to raise him according to the law. And then he died. And she still didn't have an heir. And so the next brother in line took her. And to make a long story short, all seven took her to wife. And then they died. Whose wife is she going to be in the resurrection? Remember what Jesus said about that? You err not knowing the scripture. That's a faulty analogy. There's no answer to that because that's a faulty analogy. There's no truth in it. We also remember in Matthew chapter 19, the questions of the Pharisees. Can a man divorce a woman for every cause? That's a good question, but they weren't really interested in the answer. They were trying to trap Jesus. They weren't interested in truth. In John 8, remember the woman they brought to Jesus? They caught her in adultery, caught her in the very act. Were they really interested in justice? No. They were trying to trap Jesus. If they're really interested in justice, where was the man? You don't commit adultery by yourself. You've got to have somebody else. You see, that's a faulty analogy. Men are good at this. Let me give you one that you've heard. What if a man has a heart attack and you're taking him to the water to baptize him? What about his soul? You ever heard that? That's a faulty analogy. Am I God? Am I going to determine where that person is going to spend eternity? That's God's business. The tree's not going to fall on you. You're not having a heart attack. We're right here at the building. We're not going to have to go anywhere. That's just somebody trying to escape responsibility. Now, generalization. This is another one that my brethren are pretty good at. We generalize when we assume that it's true for one person of a particular class is true of all people in that class. For example, let's say I know someone in Wisconsin that's lazy. So I just assume everybody that lives in Wisconsin is lazy. Well, we call that stereotyping too. But see, that's generalization. Could I conclude that all people are lazy just because I know one person that is? This type of reasoning is a basis for much prejudice in our society. Let me give you an example of how this works. We generalize a lot of things. I've heard all my life, well, only women gossip. I got news for you. There's no women preachers that I know, and some preachers I know, the biggest gossipers in the brotherhood, and they're men. So where did that analogy come in, that generalization, only women gossip? Do men have mouths? Do they have tongues? Can they talk? Yes, that's a false generalization. Then I heard someone says, this is a friend of mine, while we were in Nevada, she was talking about raising children to this lady that her husband was in the military. And she was really impressed with how well this man and this lady's children were. And she was really impressed with how much she cared about her children. And she says, well, you must be a Mormon. Isn't that terrible? Isn't that terrible? That's the first person that they think about would have faithful children, and people that's concerned about family is a Mormon. But that's what this lady said. That's a generalization. We make these every day, brethren. We need to be careful. You know, when you go overseas, they make a generalization, you're rich. If you live in America, you're a rich man. It doesn't make any difference where you live. And if you live in Texas, you're really rich. That's a generalization, folks. And that clouds your ability to make a judgment. Let's quickly look at the last three. Undistributed middle. The undistributed middle is similar to a generalization and is a fallacy of the undistributed middle. This reasoning assumes that what is generally true or assumed to be true of a class of people must be true for every individual in that class. We may assume that all people have a trait because they live in a particular place. Now, I had an example here about Kentucky, but I'm not going to use it because I know I'll hear about it when this lesson's over, so I'll have to use another example. But we have examples where we make people in the North. What do they say about them? Why, they're just unfriendly. They're just cold. And then we have people in the South, they're real people who love hospitality. That's what that is undistributed middle. We, too, as much prejudice in our society. But you know what? This is also spilt into the spiritual arena. Well, if you live on the West Coast, you've just fallen off the end of the world. I heard that my whole life before I ever went to Las Vegas. And you know what? I was petrified. I was petrified when I got my assignment to Las Vegas because all my life I heard, when you get past Texas, it's gone. They're gone spiritually. You know, I wondered if the church would have a neon sign, if they'd have... Well, I don't know what to expect. I didn't know what to expect. All the horror that I heard about people on the West Coast. Let me tell you something, brother. I've got news for people. The West Coast is the only people that's got religious problems. The same problems that plagued us on the West Coast, I find them right here in the good Midwest. Brethren, that's what I call undistributed middle. We put a class of people, and we just give them, because they live in a certain place, that they've got this certain problem. Brethren, I'll give you one that I learned and I had to deal with for 13 years. You're from Las Vegas. I guess you don't preach on gambling where you're at, do you? I had people in meetings ask me that. Brother Greer, you don't preach on gambling out there, do you? Why, no, I just let this all around me. I'm just a boy. No, brethren. I preach on it because it's a sin. It's part of the Bible. It's a sin. Yes, I preach on it, but that's the kind of generalizations we make. Then we have pity. Pity, that most emotions, including pity, have a legitimate place in making judgments. Read Luke 10, 33 and 34. However, pity can be, and often is, contrived solely for the purpose of influencing judgment. I'm the victim. Poor little me. I'm the one. If you don't believe, just take a look at the society that we live in. You have the victim. You have the victim who's perpetrated the crime. Turn the table that they're the ones whose rights are being violated. And they want the pity and the sympathy of others and to take away the guilt that they themselves have. Brethren, that clouds the ability to make a judgment. Many times when a problem arises in the church, people go out and get people, as I say, for lack of a better term, let's get all our ducks in a row. Let's get everybody on our side. Let's line them up. And then when we got more than they got, then we'll go forward with it. Brethren, such kind of attitudes will destroy a church. Others will stir up others. Now, have you ever seen this? There's a problem in the church. Somebody stirs a problem up in the church, and then they sit back and watch it destroying the church and say, man, I don't know what's the matter with them people. I wonder why they're acting like that. Ever seen that? I have. Brethren, that's pity that's caused to cloud judgment. And last, fear. Yeah, fear can cloud judgment. How? Well, again, fear plays a useful role in the judging process. Remember Matthew 10:28? Don't fear him that can kill the body, but fear him that can cast both body and soul into hell. Now, there's a good thing about fear, a godly fear that can be healthy and can be something that can be useful. But we must not allow an illegitimate fear to appeal to influence our judgment. Sometimes fear takes the form of intimidation. Listen, brethren. One can throw his weight around to make the road difficult for you if you don't see things my way. When I was in Las Vegas, my friend who preached where I finally ended up preaching for the last 8.5 years I was there, when he first came to town, this preacher where I was at when I first got to town went to have coffee with him. Here's the conversation they had. He said, "Now, if you want things to go well with you, if you want to have peace while you're here, here's what you do, here's what you preach on, and here's how you act." Well, what is that? That's intimidation. That's fear. I also know by personal experience where people were in a church that they knew they were in error, that knew that they were practicing things ungodly, and would not leave it because they saw what happened to other people that opposed the ungodliness, and they were afraid it would happen to them, so they just stayed there and put up with it. Brethren, I've seen that with my own eyes. That's fear and intimidation, and that will cause judgment to be clouded. Brethren, this type of tactic is evil to the core. If it takes intimidation to get people to follow God, we've missed it. We've missed it, if that's what it takes. Now, these efforts of others are real, and all 12 of these traits that I talked about today are taking place in our time. These things happen. They are not just things that I read in a book. I gave you an example from the Bible of all 12 of these traits. Things that people use to cloud judgment and make it impossible for us to make righteous judgment. We must never allow the actions and threats of others to keep us from getting to the truth. Never forget this one point. God is watching. Hebrews 4:13 says God is watching us. Everything we do is naked before him who we must give an account. You know, I think sometimes people think that what they do, because God is not here literally, that he doesn't see what goes on. Brethren, he sees everything that goes on. God is the one who can cast the final vote and the only one's vote that makes a difference. He's going to determine where I spend eternity. He's going to be my judge. He's the one that's going to say, you're going to spend eternity in heaven or you're going to spend eternity in hell. And since he has that power, I fear him more than I fear anyone else, because he has the power to do that. Now, brethren, we need to understand, if someone's going to make a judgment concerning you, would you like someone to follow one of these 12 traits in rendering a judgment about you? I wouldn't. And let me ask you one more question. How would you feel if God used one of these traits in how he judges you? You say, well, God doesn't do that. You're right. And you know what? We're his children and we ought not do it either. And what I wanted you to see about these fallacious judgments is that they are easy to do when we allow what the world does to infiltrate, or we allow it to do in our thinking, and we're going to follow what they tell us to do. Brethren, in all of these lessons, I have tried to show you and I have tried to get you to understand that the thing that we must remember is we be brethren. We are God's people. We should never forget we are God's family. And let us never stoop to using human reasoning or human theories to allow judgment to be tainted, to be false, or even to slant it one way or the other. Let us be honest enough that we will be fair about the way that we judge. And I close this part of the lesson with this verse in Matthew 7 and verse 2, where we began many weeks ago. I want to read this verse, and then the lesson is yours. Matthew 7 and verse 2. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with what measure you use it, it will be measured back to you. How does that sit with you tonight? Would you like God to judge you how you judge your fellow brethren? How you judge your fellow man? Would you feel comfortable in God treating you how you treat them? If you wouldn't, then you need to make some change. If you're here tonight and you're not a child of God, you know the Bible tells us that we must obey the gospel. We must hear the word of God, that we must believe it, that we... must be buried in water, we grave of baptism for the remission of sin. That's God's plan. We call it the plan of salvation. God calls it...